Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming to IBD IL-23 and Inflammation Oh My, following the yellow brick road and using IL-23 targeted therapies and managing IBD. I'm Corey Siegel, and I'm really proud to be here with an amazing faculty and with you tonight to talk about IL-23s. I actually did a little deep thinking about the yellow brick road, and I even used my new AI platform that I'm excited about, which is Perplexity. I've moved on to ChatGPT, and I actually wrote, you know, give me the metaphorical meaning of follow the yellow brick road, and it talked about following the path to success. And interestingly, it talks about overcoming barriers along the way. And I thought it was actually very fitting for tonight that we have great medications that we have available to us now for our patients. However, we do have a lot of barriers in getting there, and we'll talk about some of those today and how they get to our patients. So we're thrilled that you're here with us. This activity may include discussions of products and devices that are not currently labeled for use by the FDA, and the faculty have been informed of their responsibility to disclose to all of you if we'll be discussing any off-label or investigational uses of these products. As mentioned, I'm Corey Siegel. I'm the director for the Center for Digestive Health at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and also serve as the section chief there. Very, very excited to be here with my amazing faculty, and I'll have them introduce themselves. Maybe, Vincy, you can start.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Vincy Abraham, professor of clinical medicine at Houston Methodist Hospital in Houston, Texas, and I also direct the IBD program there.
Great. Thanks, Vincy. Marita.
Hi, my name is Marita Kamidas. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm a nurse practitioner and ostomy specialist practicing out of the University of Chicago Medical Center in Chicago.
Great. Thanks, Marita. And Uma Mahadevan, our local expert.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I am Uma Mahadevan. I'm an IBD gastroenterologist and director of the IBD Center at the University of California, San Francisco.
Great. Thanks, everybody. We'll hit a few learning objectives over the course of this next hour. First is to identify the role of pro-inflammatory cytokines in the pathogenesis of IBD. Let's set the stage and make sure we understand why this pathway around IL-23 is even important. After that, we'll dive into evaluating the role of IL-23 and Th17, the inflammatory axis in IBD pathogenesis. Again, let's just make sure we understand why we're thinking about this pathway and why these medications work. And then we'll move into appraising the clinical implications of anti-IL-23 agents used in the treatment of IBD to bind specifically CD64 receptors in IL-23-producing cells. And then learning objective four, finally, is to develop individualized treatment plans for patients with IBD that are eligible for treatment with an IL-23 targeted agent and other agents. And we'll end this discussion with some case presentations at the end to really think practically how we use these medications. Before we move into the content and to make sure everyone's iPads are working, we are going to ask you one question to weigh in on here. So please do go to your iPads. And the question is, what factors most heavily influence your selection of therapy for IBD? Please pick your top three. We are curious to see what you say, and then we'll have a little discussion about that afterwards. Marita, what do you think about the responses there? Maybe you want to just comment and just thinking from your perspective and work how these different factors influence our decision making.
Sure. Certainly, we can make an argument for any of these that they're all important. But I think the one that sticks out the most to me is matching the severity of disease with the appropriate intensity of treatment.
Great. Vincy, any further comments here or things that you think about when you're sitting with your patients?
Well, I'm actually just thinking about my part of the slide deck, and I'm going to be talking about safety and efficacy, so yeah. It looks like that's the most important, so I better do a good job for you guys tonight.
Great. All right, thanks, everyone. It looks like the iPads are working. At this time, I'm going to turn things over to Uma. Uma is going to be talking to us about illuminating pathways and optimizing IL-23 inhibition. Thanks, Uma.
Great. Thank you, Corey, and good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here today. So when we think about inflammatory bowel disease, we think about the interaction between susceptibility genes an environmental trigger, and then an active immune system. And when that innate immune system turns on, you produce cytokines that lead you down the inflammatory pathway. And one of those is IL-23, which is why it's been such a successful target for both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. When you inhibit IL-23, you can reduce mucosal inflammation, you can improve epithelial barrier integrity, and you can suppress gut inflammation. Now, what's important is that when you block IL-23, you still protect IL-17. IL-17 is a very interesting story because it's both protective and inflammatory. And there are anti-IL-17 agents that are FDA approved for psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis. But when they tried it for Crohn's disease, those were the one of the few trials that I'm aware of that were stopped for actually causing harm. So remember, don't let your patients with IBD get anti-IL-17 therapy. And if you have somebody on that who has bowel symptoms, always think about IBD. So when you have IL-17, it has both protective and pathogenic effects. So here you have your Th17 cell producing IL-17, and this leads to granulopoiesis and neutrophil recruitment, which then helps deal with pathogens and preserve barrier integrity. But when you have too much IL-17, you get into pathogenesis with psoriasis, IBD, encephalomyelitis, arthritis, and periodontitis. So it's really important to have that balance, and the anti-IL-23s do not block IL-17 too much. So here you can see what happens. You have IL-23, you have an antigen, and I don't have a mouse, but you can see a laser, no. So let me go back one here. So you have all the way at the top the antigen, which then activates the antigen-presenting cell. You have a naive T helper cell that then becomes activated and can turn into Th1, Th2, or Th17 cells. And here you have Th17 cells. If you go down the left pathway, in the presence of IL-23, that Th17 cell is activated and secretes pathogenic cytokines like IL-17, interferon, IL-23. But if you go down the right arm, in the absence of IL-23, it's homeostatic non-inflammatory cytokines. So it's really important in the differentiation of the Th17 cell whether there's IL-23 or not. And this is a beautiful cartoon showing the epithelial barrier. And what you're going to see is the antigen-presenting cell, the dendritic cell there at the bottom, secreting IL-23, IL-1, and TNF-beta. And in blue, you have the naive T helper cells, which now become activated and start secreting IL-17, IL-21, IL-22, and start disrupting the epithelial barrier, causing apoptosis and inflammatory bowel disease. And so this is the mechanism that you're trying to block by blocking IL-23. Here at the very top slide is a normal colon, and then in the bottom left, slide A is a patient with active Crohn's disease, and slide B is a patient with active ulcerative colitis. And they stained here for IL-23 expression. You can see in the normal on the top, there's no IL-23, but in Crohn's, there's significant IL-23 detection as well as in ulcerative colitis, not to the same extent. And again, on the right, you see that in graphic form, the expression of IL-23P19 is significant in Crohn's compared to control patients and control biopsies, ulcerative colitis less so, but still more. So IL-23 is a very important cytokine for inflammation. And here you can see the in a patient who responds to anti-TNF versus doesn't respond. So you have somebody with inflammatory bowel disease, you give them anti-TNF therapy, and on the macrophage, it blocks the TNF receptor, so it doesn't activate the CD4 T cell. And that T cell undergoes apoptosis, and you have resolution of inflammation. But in a non-responder, even if you block the TNF receptor, you still can have the IL-23 receptor. And when IL-23 binds there, you have expansion of the CD4 IL-23 receptors and cells. And here you have propagation of inflammation by increasing the inflammatory cells because you have a second receptor here that's not being blocked. So here are the three anti-P19s, which we have available: guselkumab, mirikizumab, and risankizumab. And these block the P19 subunit of IL-23. Ustekinumab blocks the P40 subunit IL-23 as well as for IL-12. And IL-12 doesn't seem to be as important on its own in this inflammatory cascade. So there are also Fc gamma receptors on the surface of immune cells that recognize the Fc portion of IgG. The CD64 Fc gamma R1 is the only Fc gamma receptor with a high affinity for IgG1. And these CD64 cells are the primary cellular source for IL-23 and IBD. And so if you look here, all the way in your left column, the Fc gamma R1, you can see that with the number sign, those that have inducible expression, meaning that in the presence of an antigen or a stimulus, you induce the gene product. But monocytes and macrophages, which produce IL-23, these can have constitutive expression, meaning that they can have unregulated ongoing expression. So guselkumab and risankizumab can have different molecular attributes. They both have the P19 receptor for IL-23. They're both IgG1. Guselkumab is fully human and has a native or wild-type Fc domain, while risankizumab has a mutated LALA or leucine to alanine sequence, and so is humanized. Here you can see on the left the humanized risankizumab receptor, and on the right the fully human IgG1 with the native wild-type Fc component. So in the presence of IL-23, both will bind the free-floating IL-23 P19 subunit here. And on the surface of inflammatory myeloid cells like monocytes, risankizumab will not bind the CD64 receptor on these cells that secrete IL-23, and they'll bind the IL-23 that's being secreted, that's free-floating, but not what's coming immediately out of the cell. When you look at guselkumab, it does bind to the CD64 receptor, so it binds the IL-23 as it comes out of the cell, as well as the ones that are free-floating. This work from Raja Atreya's lab in Germany looked at in vitro evaluations of CD64 and IL-23 binding. And so on the left, they looked at mean fluorescence intensity of guselkumab inside these cells, so intracellular monoclonal antibody. And you can see the blue line that there was increased guselkumab inside these cells, suggesting that it bound the CD64 receptor and was internalized. But risankizumab did not do that. And to the right, you can see that that there was also intracellular IL-23 that was picked up with the guselkumab. Mirikizumab does not bind to CD64. This was a study that looked at that versus a positive control and showed that it did not bind to CD64. So which of the following is true regarding binding affinity of IL-23 inhibitors to CD64 receptors?
What do you think, Uma? How'd they do?
Great.
All right. Great. Excellent. Well, thank you. As we move on to Binti, please keep questions coming. We're getting some questions that are starting to filter in. One was a comment that just said, thank you for the great animations, Uma. So,
okay. I wish I could say I created
there.
Them.
Uma drew them herself.
I just vocalized them.
Yeah. Thank you. Wonderful. Binti, take us away. One of the other questions that came in was, well, what about the safety data and the efficacy data? So perfectly tease it up for you.
Perfect. All right. So I'll talk about the data that we have from the IL-23 inhibitors. Oh, it's going on one side and not the other. Can you guys? Okay. I'll start with ulcerative colitis data. So mirikizumab was studied in the Lucent 1 and 2 trials for ulcerative colitis. And so during this trial, we had patients who had moderate to severe active ulcerative colitis, adult patients, and these were randomized to a 3-to-1 ratio to get mirikizumab. The dosing was 300 milligrams IV every 4-week dosing at week 0, week 4, week 8, and at week 12, we looked at who responded. So there was a placebo arm as well. Now, if they were on mirikizumab, actually got the drug, and responded, they were then re-randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to continue to get mirikizumab, but in the sub-Q form, 200 milligrams every 4 weeks, or the placebo arm. And we looked at one-year data, so week 40, to see how these patients did. Now, when we looked at the induction data at the week 12 point, we saw that it met all the primary endpoint and the 3 secondary endpoints as well. So clinical remission, again, in the UC trial included endoscopic improvement, the Mayo score, as well as the clinical factors of improvement in and lack of rectal bleeding, and also going back to baseline of their stool frequency. And we found that a quarter of these patients, as early as week 12 after induction, the 3 induction doses achieved clinical remission. And if you looked at the secondary endpoints, which is probably more clinically meaningful because we're not always scoping our patients 3 months in of starting a new drug, we want to see if they're responding. So 64% of our patients achieve clinical response, meaning improvement in their rectal bleeding, improvement in their bowel frequency after they've gotten the 3 IV induction doses. Now, we also looked at endoscopic assessment for these patients. 36% of our patients already achieved endoscopic remission, meaning Mayo Zero actually had moderate to severe inflammation coming into the trial, but by after those 3 induction doses, by the end of induction study, more than a third of our patients actually achieved endoscopic remission. We looked even further, looked at histological endoscopic mucosal improvement, and 27% of patients on mirikizumab actually achieved this as well. So we're looking deeper and deeper into remission data here. Now, the nice thing with the mirikizumab trial and the Lucent trial is that we actually looked at bowel urgency. We found a reduction in their bowel urgency as early as 2 weeks in. So that's after that first IV induction dose, we saw a difference between the mirikizumab group versus the placebo group, and that difference was statistically significant at week 12. We looked at that in finish at the induction data as well, which we know bowel urgency is one of the most brutal quality of life issues in our patients living with UC as well. Now, when we looked at the one-year data, week 40 endpoint of the maintenance part of trial called Lucent 2, we saw that it also met the primary endpoint of clinical remission, but also all 5 major secondary endpoints. So half your patients were in clinical remission at that week 40 or one-year mark. And we looked at all the other endpoints of steroid-free remission, maintenance of clinical remission. So if you had a patient who was doing well, already in clinical remission at week 12, 64% of your patients maintained that remission 40 weeks later. 59, almost 60% of patients achieved endoscopic remission by that 1 year, 43% histoendoscopic remission, and bowel urgency remission, 43%. So pretty significant data here if you're looking at all across these endpoints. Now, the nice thing is because mirikizumab was one of our earlier IL-23s to get approved, we now have 3-year data from the open-label extension study. And we're seeing here, if you look at non-responder imputation, observed case analysis, we're seeing pretty high numbers here, 81, 85, 80, and even 97% of the observed case analysis of patients that actually stayed into the study are maintaining on this medication. So the nice thing to know, at least that we're seeing in this, and we don't have the data yet for the other agents, that there's perseverance of this drug. Perhaps because these medications are not immunogenic, as we've seen in the anti-TNF data that we've seen in the past. So it's maybe one component of it. Or is it that the IL-23 blockade, this mechanism, is actually working long and it's not coming out? The immune response or the immune system is not finding another pathway to cause inflammation. So the etiology remains to be and understood, but there's some of the theories that I have and why we're seeing this persistence of the patients being on these medications. And we now compared the treatment, the advanced treatment naive patient to the treatment experienced patient. Interestingly, some of the data that we're looking at between the different IL-23s with mirikizumab. You see a slight delta, but about maybe 5% between the clinical remission data group and endoscopic remission, about a 10-11% delta here. So if you're bio or tofacitinib naive, but back then we didn't have UPA patients on this trial, 52% achieved clinical remission versus 46% achieved it on MIRI if they had previously been on a biologic or TOFA or both. Endoscopic remission, 62% achieved endoscopic remission if you're advanced therapy naive, and 51% still achieved endoscopic remission by that 1 year despite prior failure by advanced therapies. So still pretty good to know, and from a clinical practice perspective, useful to know that at least mirikizumab, and you'll see the other data with the other IL-23s, so we can use this after prior advanced therapy failures in our UC patient population. Now let's move on to risankizumab. The INSPIRE and COMMAND trials were the induction and the maintenance parts of the study. Here again, similarly, moderate to severe active UC patients were randomized to either get the risankizumab 1,200 milligram IV induction dosing week 0, 4, and 8, and we looked at week 12 as the primary endpoint of clinical remission and compare that to the placebo. Of course, they were responders and were on risankizumab. They went on to the maintenance part of the trial. If they were non-responders, they had additional 12-week induction treatment as well. We'll point to the maintenance part of the study when they continue to get on risankizumab here. We looked at similar endpoints, primary and secondary endpoints. So what did we find? At week 12, we saw the clinical response that, again, clinically what we would use in our practice, 64%, very similar numbers. Again, we don't have head-to-head trials as of yet. We're seeing pretty similar numbers here. Clinical response at week 12 after the three IV induction doses on patients on risankizumab achieved this. Clinical remission, again, a bit harder endpoint because you include the endoscopic scoring as well, 20% achieved this at week 12. If you look at the secondary endpoints, clinical response based on different adapted Mayo scores, endoscopic improvement, endoscopic remission, and histological endoscopic improvement as well, we're seeing pretty good, again, statistically significant of the risankizumab compared to the placebo group, but also great responses here as well, and looking as early as week 12 in the induction trial. Now, moving on to the maintenance or the COMMAND trial, here we had two different doses of the maintenance risankizumab. So we had 180 sub-Q dosing every 8 weeks or 360 milligrams sub-Q every 8 weeks, comparing that to the placebo group. Here we're seeing about 38 to 40% of patients overall achieving clinical remission at week 52. And again, you're seeing that the difference between the RISA 180 versus 360, not a huge difference here. And then if you compare this to the advanced therapy failure versus the naive group, we're seeing a difference in delta here, up to about 62% of patients on RISA 360 sub-Q achieving clinical remission at 1 year if they're prior advanced therapy naive compared to about 36 to 30% in the other groups, on the RISA groups, if they had previously been exposed and had an intolerance or non-response to those other drugs. And without going into every finite percentages with all the secondary endpoints, don't worry, I'm not going to do a pop quiz on exact percentages here, but you get the gist that in general, of course, being on the drug looked way better than being on placebo, keeping in mind that the placebo numbers are not super low here, mainly because they all had the three IV induction doses of the drug to start out with before they went on to the maintenance. There could be some potential lasting effect with the placebo groups here. But what we're seeing is that there's not a huge difference between that 180 versus a 360 milligram dosing in the maintenance arms here. Perhaps a maintenance of clinical remission, but again, that's including patients who were doing well on the 180. I mean, after the induction dosing, they continue to do well despite being on a slightly lower dose, 180 versus 360 here. But you can see other things, endoscopic improvement, HEMI scores, endoscopic remission, the symptom scores of no bowel urgency, no abdominal pain, pretty similar between the two dosing groups here as well.
Vincy, before you move on, yes. There was a question from the audience about mm-hmm. the high placebo rates, and you touched on it, but can you just explain what you mean by this carryover effect again?
Right. So, you know, with IL-23 inhibition perhaps working on our immune cells at a higher level, perhaps we're suppressing further IL-23s being formed, or it actually interacting with other immune cells to cause other cytokine production. So perhaps we're capturing it pretty early on, that there's this lasting effect, not just from the drug lasting longer in their system as far as half-life, but maybe its biologic effect is actually lasting a bit longer, in that we're seeing this, you know, effect going up to 1 year in. So right. At least that's my suspicion. But if you have any other thoughts, too.
No, I think it's a good sign, and it's a question that comes up all the time. Right. And then if you don't mind, another question that I'll anticipate would come from the audience, mm-hmm. although I don't see it yet, is the decision between 180 and 360. And if I were to sort of rank order questions I get from my colleagues, very high up there is, when do I pick which dose?
Right. So very good question. So if you look, you know, advanced therapy, naive, or that's one of the bigger questions. Like, well, maybe if they failed multiple agents before, should I consider using a higher dosing? We're not really seeing that. In fact, we're seeing numerically perhaps a higher in the 180 sub-Q in the risankizumab group at least. So yeah, there's a lot of data here. The question is, I don't know if I have an exact answer. Perhaps I might start with the lower dose and then hope that they do respond, but then maybe mentally or from an insurance perspective that I have something to move up to if they're not responding to the 180, that I can say, well, maybe I need to go to 360 in the future. Or I can just say, you know what, let me just start with the 360.
Well, you know, one interesting thing, if you remember back to the basic science part of this, is that patients who are advanced therapy exposed, those are the ones that have the TNF receptor, but also the IL-23 perhaps secreting. And so we know that blocking the TNF was not enough. And though you may be selecting for those that their mechanism is IL-23, which is why you don't necessarily need as much, and it's one possibility.
Great. All right, Marita, any further comment on that in your practice and how you're making these decisions?
Yeah, I think it's hard. It's hard to say sometimes for some of our patients. Certainly, we always want to use the lowest effective dose. That being said, I work in a tertiary care center with very refractory patients, and so I found in my clinical experience a lot more success with the 360 dose. Okay.
Great. Thank you. All right. Thanks, Vincent.
All right. Okay. And with, now this is, again, looking at the risankizumab group in the treatment-naive versus treatment-experienced patient, and you saw the 20%, this is after the IV induction dosing, looking at clinical remission rates, but we're seeing that there's a significant delta between the prior experience versus those that are treatment naive, essentially, as far as advanced therapy. So almost 30% of the patients who were non-advanced therapy patients actually achieved clinical remission versus 11.4% after the advanced therapy group. So this is important clinically because, you know, you're seeing this 11%, but remember, this is the induction part of the study. So what we don't want to do is have our patients lose hope that, oh, this medicine's not going to work. Perhaps these patients need a longer period of drug getting onto the maintenance arm before we actually start seeing some improvement in these patients, too. But this was good to see that difference in the delta. Right, now moving on to guselkumab in UC, the QUASAR study. Similarly, we had induction part of the study where there was IV induction. Here, there was two types of studies. One was the 2B and 3, where we had 400 IV versus 200 IV every four-week doses for the induction study 1. And the other group had the guselkumab 200 milligrams IV every four-week dosing. Again, they had 0, 4, 8, and then at week 12, we looked at clinical remission as primary endpoint. And then those that got guselkumab IV, regardless of whichever type of IV induction it was, and who responded, actually moved on to the maintenance. And during the maintenance, they were re-randomized to get either guselkumab 200 sub-Q every four-week dosing or 100 milligrams every 8-week dosing, or placebo. Now, keeping in mind, this wasn't a double dose like there is in Kisumab data. This was a quadruple dose difference as well. So if you haven't seen the data yet, this is actually interesting to see that, the difference here. So how did these patients do? Well, in the induction part of the trial, primary endpoint was met. 23% of patients on guselkumab, regardless of whichever IV, achieved this clinical remission as a primary endpoint. And we looked at the secondary endpoints. We're seeing 50% symptomatic remission. Clinical response, again, that's 60% data, 62% achieved this. Endoscopic improvement, 27%. And then histological endoscopic improvement, 24% as well. So very similar numbers with the IV induction with all of these studies here. Now, let's look at the 1 year week 44 data. So if you look, again, you have the dark blue as your 200 every 4 week, the more intense dosing. The light blue is your 100 every 8 week dosing, and then the placebos in gray. We're seeing about half your patients achieve clinical remission at week 44. For guselkumab, it was 50 versus 45 between the two dosing. Now, if you look at all the secondary endpoints, steroid-free remission, maintenance of remission, clinical response, symptomatic remission, endoscopic improvement, and histological endoscopic improvement, even endoscopic remission, and we looked at fatigue and IBD-Q as well, you're seeing very similar numbers between the two dosing. Very interesting, very fascinating that a quadruple dose difference didn't really make a quadruple difference in efficacy in any of these endpoints, even any of the secondary endpoints either. So that was quite interesting. Now, how about when we looked at treatment naive versus the treatment experienced patients? Again, looking at the 100, 200 differences here. If you are bio or JAK inhibitor naive patient population, not a huge difference between the, so 38 versus 42%. Numerically, not much of a difference there. Interestingly, in the group that previously had exposure to biologic JAK inhibitors, we're seeing so much of that risen Kisumab data. The smaller dosing, 100 milligrams, 31% versus 24% with guselkumab, 200 every 4 weeks. Fascinating. Thoughts on this from our group here?
Yeah, I mean, we just are speculating, but there's always been speculation about saturation of the receptors, and that maybe, you know, we saw that with the initial infliximab trials where 5 versus 10 mgs per kg right off the bat, that the 10 milligrams per kilogram was not better than 5, which is why we have 5. At some point, you saturate the receptors, and more doesn't make a difference. But why it would be less, particularly in bioexposed, hard to explain.
Yeah, I think as we get new classes of biologics, we learn that they're not all the same, right? They behave differently, and we've learned that, you know, despite 5 versus 10 to start, we have become so accustomed with dose escalating, particularly in infliximab, and the responsiveness that we get, that we just expect that to happen, you know, with other drug classes too. So Uma, there was a question here about therapeutic drug monitoring with IL-23. So we're not doing this routinely. Is this something that you've thought about and wish that you had drug levels, or are the data that Bintzi are showing tell you that it maybe doesn't matter?
So personally, I really only use therapeutic drug monitoring for infliximab. It is available for risankizumab. You can order it through Prometheus Labs, but I don't know what the level should be or how to use it. And I think we saw with ustekinumab that sometimes increasing that the levels didn't really matter. And so I am not using therapeutic drug monitoring here.
Yeah, I think the pendulum has gone back and forth on this, right? We totally embrace therapeutic drug monitoring when we fully understood with infliximab how effective it can be, and I still stick to the fact that that is a tool that you need to use when you're using infliximab. I think you're being almost irresponsible with infliximab if we're not following levels. But with these other drug classes, we just haven't seen it. Even with other anti-TNFs, we haven't seen it as much. There are a lot of questions about safety, and I know you're going to move on in a minute, but before we do there, Marita, I just want you to comment on urgency. And we talked about it briefly, and it was an important endpoint in the mirikizumab studies. But just give us all a thought of how you approach this with your patients and how this comes up. I find that if you don't ask your patients about urgency, you may never know about it. And maybe what's the next question you ask after they tell you that they experience urgency?
Certainly. I think it's important for our patients with ulcerative colitis, but also with Crohn's disease. I mean, we need to know about frequency and urgency and nighttime bowel movements. I often find I've got a very young patient population, and I'll say, how often are you having a bowel movement? And they'll say, well, once a day, but they're having seven overnight. So you've got to ask the question so they know to be able to volunteer that information in the future. But certainly, as you had commented, you know, urgency can be one of the most problematic quality of life issues for our patients. And so getting early and tight control of that is really meaningful from a long-term standpoint for disease control, but also for our patients to be able to regain some of that confidence to kind of get out of the bathroom and get back to living their life in the way that they'd like to be.
Thank you. Uma, how do you ask your patients about incontinence? Like, what's the sentence you use to inquire about this?
I say, do you have accidents when, you know, where you lose stool, or do you have trouble differentiating between gas and stool?
Yeah. And then another, I do the same, and another question I ask is, does having ulcerative colitis prevent you from going out of the house at any time? And then you start really hearing the impact on their quality of life, and there were a couple of questions here about quality of life. Bincy, just to clarify, you know, you showed three drugs and one that specifically looked at urgency with IL-23s. Do you think it's a drug-specific thing or a good treatment thing that happens that we treat urgency better?
Yeah. No, I don't think it's a drug-specific thing. Riz and Kisumab also had the data as well as a secondary endpoint. So I think, of course, we know that healing the bowel can reduce bowel urgency, but in some cases, we may heal the bowel and they may still have urgency as well. So it's important to still ask those patients, despite you have them in endoscopic remission or even ultrasound transmural healing, because some of these patients may lead, you know, have other, you know, fibrosis components or other pelvic floor dysfunction trying to deal with their disease for so long too. But I don't think, to answer your specifically your question, I don't think it's necessarily drug specific. It's nice that we studied it with the mirikizumab data and have some secondary endpoints of the risen kisumab data as well. But it's an important endpoint that we should be asking our patients beyond the clinical trial.
Yeah, I was talking to one of our colleagues earlier across the street at the meeting, saying how frequent it is that you'll ask a patient about urgency and they'll say no, and then you go to do an exam in the office and they're wearing an adult diaper, and you then inquire why that is, and they say, well, because they're worried about that occurring, even if they're not having it. So there really is this sense of the other, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop, that something bad is going to happen, and all it takes is one experience. All of our patients can tell us that time that at the office, on an airplane, you know, some terrible situation where they experienced incontinence that really, in a sense, broke their confidence almost forever, that we need to rebuild, and with medications like these, we can do that. I'll let you go on with safety. There are a lot of questions about it, and boy, we're in a different era of safety now with biologics than we used to be.
It is. It's I'm excited to actually talk about the safety data. So we'll start with mirikizumab, and this is what was published after the trial with the 200 every 4 week dosing sub-Q maintenance part of the study. We'll see that, you know, of course, I like to joke that if anyone sneezes when we're in a clinical trial, they get one sneeze for free, but the second sneeze, we got to report it. So, you know, so if you see safety and you see adverse events and you see like 63.7% had safety issues, well, what were that? Was it two sneezes or was it a cold or was it a serious infection? So this is where if you look at the AEs of special interest, 30% had infections. But keep in mind that the MIRI and the risankizumab trials were ongoing during the COVID era, and the guselkumab trials was outside when things were kind of, you know, better from the COVID as well. So keep that in mind. We're looking at the safety as well. But if you look at serious infections, malignancy, allergic, you know, hypersensitivity reactions, injection site reactions, discontinuation, pretty low numbers here. And we look at the recent KisreMap safety data, and you look, and you can actually here compare the 180 versus the 360, because you have the higher and the lower dosing here. If you compare that to the placebo, what we're seeing in general is that adverse events were actually very similar to the placebo. In fact, in some cases, the placebo patients had higher adverse events, such as in, if you look here, well, of course, you had AEs related to COVID-19, again, keeping in mind that this was during that COVID era, serious infection, 2.3 versus 1.1 or 0.6. Of course, injection site reactions more common with actual drug compared to placebo injections, of course. And really, otherwise, AEs were very similar across the board. And so, and now let me move on to guselkumab safety as well. Again, regardless of 200 versus the 400 in the combined data, any AEs, you can see numbers in the placebo slightly higher and, or pretty much very similar to the groups here. Serious adverse events, 5.7 versus the 1 or 2 and 3 with the guselkumab group. So I, you know, if you combine all this data together, what we're seeing is either the same safety as a placebo, or in some cases, perhaps even higher safety issues with placebo because our patients are not, or their disease are not under control. So I love using this when patients come to me, they need advanced therapy, and they're so worried about starting a biologic because they're worried about the safety of the biologic. And I think it's on us to explain to our patients that there's a safety issue with untreated disease. There are adverse events that can happen. Of course, all the complications of their disease, but also long-term things that the patients don't think about, like colon cancer risk after 8 years plus of their disease, or having, you know, having to have surgery, or their quality of life issues, the urgency, why do they have to worry about that if we could potentially get them under control and avoid the safety issues, essentially, quote unquote, from having active inflammation. So it's this like game changer as far as talking about safety. They're like, really, the placebo patients had more issues or the same as the drug? Like, yeah, they did. And they're like, oh, I think this is a safe drug. And then they feel more accepted about taking advanced therapy when I show them this data. Now, moving on to Crohn's disease, at least now you know kind of how the studies were done, so I won't go into belabor into all of the details here, but we have data from Advanced and Motivate studies from risankizumab. What we see after these patients are randomized, or they had either 1,200 or 600 IV induction doses, if they responded, then we re-randomized the clinical responders, and then we looked at the data afterwards. So here in the Advanced study, we see that if you look, the 600 versus a 1,200 milligram dosing, once again, not a huge difference. In fact, maybe the 600 milligrams actually perhaps looked numerically a bit better than the 1,200. Again, met the endpoints of clinical remission, looking at CDI scoring, clinical remission looking at stool frequency and abdominal pain scores, and endoscopic response. So 40% of our patients achieved endoscopic response on 600 IV every four-week induction dosing at week 12 during the induction part of the trial. And if you look at the Motivate study, which were really the biofailure group, so Advanced had a bit of the non-biofailure and a small group of a bit mixed of the biofailure and the only conventional therapy, but Motivate pretty much had all biofailure population, and here we're seeing very similar numbers too. CDI scoring, 42%, 41%. Clinical remission rate, 35%, 39%. Endoscopic response, 29%, 34% of these patients. So here, maybe with the biofailure group, we're seeing a little bit of a difference from the 600, the 1,200 IV induction dosing. Now we move on to the maintenance part of the study called Fortify at 1 year, week 52. We see that clinical remission rates, 41%. An endoscopic response of 22%. If you look at the difference between the 180 and the 360 during the maintenance part of the study, okay, this is the, if you're looking at that group, 55% clinical remission, 52% clinical remission, the 180 versus 360, and the endoscopic response was identical. So very interesting to see that. Now, there was a study talking about head-to-head with risankizumab versus ustekinumab in Crohn's. This is called the sequence trial. And of course, the dosing was 600 IV induction for Riza with 360 every 8 weeks for the maintenance. Compared that to our standard IV ustekinumab and the standard 90 every 8 week dosing. And they stratified, of course, based on prior anti-TNF failure, steroid use at baseline, and they had to have moderate to severe Crohn's disease based on CDI scoring and looked at the results of these patients. And what we found is that endoscopic remission and mucosal healing, both at week 24 and week 48, risankizumab patients had higher rates of remission and healing compared to ustekinumab patients. So this is our kind of early IL-23 versus an IL-12-23 head-to-head trial in Crohn's that showed that Riza was actually better than ustekinumab. And these are looking at objective markers, so endoscopic remission, looking at mucosal healing data here. Now, there's another study called VIVID-1, looked at mirikizumab versus ustekinumab, similarly in moderate to severe Crohn's disease, randomized to get either mirikizumab, the 900 IV every four, then went to 300 sub-Q every four-week dosing versus the standard ustekinumab IV induction to the maintenance. Or they also started with the placebo group that had IV only, but then the non-responders actually went on to get the mirikizumab dosing. The responders continued on placebo. So it's lucky patients who, you know, responded to placebo and continued to respond on placebo. Now, how did these patients do? Interestingly, with miri versus ustekinumab, we actually didn't see a difference between the two groups here regarding endoscopic response at week 52, clinical remission based on CDI scoring. And if you then compare to the biologic failed versus biologic naive, again, no major difference between the two groups between endoscopic response and the clinical remission scores as well. So we have two IL-23s. There's two different head-to-head. Saw a difference between the Riza, but not so with the mirikizumab. Not sure how to explain this. Any thoughts on this at all?
I think we need a tiebreaker drug.
Drug. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think you were expecting me to talk about guselkumab here. There was not a head-to-head per se, but in the GALAXY trial, we actually looked at guselkumab. Different dosing versus ustekinumab was one of the arms of this trial. So we had the IV guselkumab 200, 600, 1200, and then the darkest blue is the guselkumab, all of them combined together versus ustekinumab. Here, we're not really seeing a huge difference between the combined, but if you look at the 200 milligram dosing versus the ustekinumab, you're seeing the CDI score difference about 25 change here. Now, that's great if you look at the induction dosing, but how did these patients do closer to a year, 48 weeks in the GALAXY 2 and 3 trial? You're starting to see that either the 200 IV going to 100 every 8 weeks or after the 200 IV induction going to 200 every four-week dosing. Again, the guselkumab dose, not much difference, but we are seeing a statistically significant difference between the guselkumab versus the ustekinumab dosing here. Looking at endoscopic response at week 48, the endoscopic remission data, clinical remission and endoscopic response combined, what was approaching statistical significance but didn't meet it just yet, the p-value of 0.058 was clinical remission data. But more of the objective evidence, endoscopic response and remission, we actually did see a difference between ustekinumab versus the guselkumab, regardless of the dose of guselkumab here. So you do have your tiebreaker. but anyway, fascinating to see two different IL-23s versus one that did not show a difference between ustekinumab. Any thoughts besides this tie-breaking drug?
Yeah, I mean, it comes, there's going to be a slide you're going to show, I think, in a little bit of really comparing these drugs against each other, and maybe we can save the discussion for, like, what are the distinguishing features that make us think about one IL-23 versus another, because it's hard when we have classes of drugs that have the same or almost the same, you know, similar mechanisms with slightly different results.
Right. And keeping in mind, we're not head-to-heading against all of these with ustekinumab. These are individual trials, right, too. So speaking of differentiation, we do have some data on subcutaneous guselkumab induction, because all of these studies so far we've showed all required IV induction, right? 3 IV induction doses, 4 weeks apart. So we do now have subcutaneous guselkumab induction data, the phase 3 GRAVITY study, and we found, again, we're comparing the guselkumab IV induction week 12 data, 56% achieved clinical remission at week 12 after getting guselkumab 400 every 4-week dosing. So instead of IV, they got guselkumab sub-Q for every 4 weeks, and at week 12, looked at the data here. And bio-naive, 50%, bio-experienced, 60% achieved clinical remission. If you look at endoscopic response, 41% achieved this. And if you look at the bio-naive versus bio-experienced, 49% had endoscopic response, and 33% who had bio-experienced actually achieved endoscopic response on guselkumab with IV induction, I'm sorry, sub-Q induction dosing here. So we don't have a direct comparison to the IV, but very similar numbers to what we saw with the IV guselkumab induction data.
And before you go, if we can, I'd love to stop here for a second, because I do think this is one of these distinguishing features of one of the medications. Uma, when you first heard about or saw these data for GRAVITY, you know, what were you thinking as far as, oh, how this might change your practice?
One prior authorization.
Right. So for all of us who are, you know, writing prescriptions for these medications and therapy plans and working through all the hurdles, to me, this is really transformative in the way of getting. And I don't know how it works in Chicago, Marita, but for me, it's my nurse practitioner who takes the brunt of getting these different medications going. But, you know, what's your thought about how patients will think about this from sub-Q induction versus IV induction?
Yeah, I think it simplifies things. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have an embedded pharmacist who takes the burden of that primarily. But I think even just in the confusion in communication with patients where they'll receive the letter for IV being denied and sub-Q being approved and trying to explain to the patients that pharmacy benefits and medical benefits don't necessarily communicate to one another, I think it's really going to expedite our patients' access to therapy. And I think it also gives them another option for patients that perhaps have a far journey to an infusion center or are away at college, we're seeing virtually. I think it really is a good opportunity for patients.
Right. Options are good, right? And we're seeing this evolve through our field of options for sub-Q and almost all of our medications so far. And not shown here tonight because not yet released, but coming in two weeks at ECHO, will be sub-Q induction data about ulcerative colitis as well. So we're learning more as we go here. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Vincy.
Sure. And so I'll summarize here the safety of the IL-23 inhibitors in the Crohn's disease studies. And again, we're seeing pretty similar numbers all across as well. Pretty low rates of serious adverse events. And then if you compare this, I'm not showing it here, to the placebo, very similar to the placebo numbers as well. So you have it here. We have the safety in both in Crohn's and UC, pretty similar. But now I think this is a very important slide. It's almost like I need to keep memorized infliximab and adalimumab dosing, and then we had Vedo and ustekinumab and all the others. It's like, oh, we have 3 IL-23s. There's, 3 IV induction doses. There are different types of sub-Q, maintenance dosing. It's almost like I need to keep a copy of this, almost like a card of this in my clinic, because I can't even keep up with what's for which indication. So I think this is a very important slide. So for guselkumab, you saw the all of them right now IV induction 0-4-8, but each have different IV in milligram dosing for them. When you get to the maintenance, though, you have some options with the guselkumab and with risankizumab. Miri is pretty straightforward, 200 every 4 weeks. Now, UC dosing is a bit different from Crohn's disease dosing as well, so keep that in mind. So if you remembered something for UC and you get the Crohn's indication and for the patient, then make sure you adjust the dosing accordingly for the correct disease.
Well, what's weird is for MIRI, it's lower for UC and higher for Crohn's, and RISA, it's higher for UC and lower for Crohn's. Yes. And so you have to remember that.
Remember that too. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. If you're going to take a picture of anything and make a pocket card out of it, this is your slide. Like, this is the one to keep straight. And don't feel bad if it's hard to keep it straight, because I think you heard Vincy admit, as I would as well, I need to look this up for the different dosing here.
Refilled IV order form, so you just click the box. You see, you don't have to remember. I would highly recommend that.
Uma, going back to the beginning of mechanisms and thinking about how these drugs work and maybe some slight difference in mechanisms, looking at the dosing strategy, I mean, does this line up for you as far as how we put the story together about one drug versus the other, or do we have three good drugs in a class that we can pick from?
We have three good drugs in a class that we can pick from. Yeah, and until they're truly compared head-to-head, it's hard to say clinically that one is better than the other, and it comes down to ease of use and access. I think they all three have great efficacy. They all have great safety. You know, you can do network meta-analyses like the AGA did for UC, and that ended up putting risin guselkumab above mirikizumab, but that's an NMA and not a head-to-head trial.
Right. Still more to learn, and certainly more to learn in clinical practice. We don't have a lot of experience with these drugs other than perhaps risankizumab for Crohn's disease, you know, which has been the longest. When you're talking with patients, I agree with you, Vinci, that this is an easy safety conversation to have. You know, one thing I would suggest as you're seeing patients, when you sense that fear of side effects of patients, I believe that many patients lump biologics together, and it's hard to distinguish. And nor should we expect that our patients who don't think about this all day long are able to sort out the differences. But I use the strategy you do as well, Vinci, of I do think people, even people who aren't in the healthcare world, understand placebo, and talking about the fact that there are no increased side effects from the drug compared to placebo, yet patients who are untreated have more adverse events related to their disease as well.
And I specifically say no increased risk of infection or cancer, because those are the two things they read about online, and people are surprised.
Right. They're not coming in worried about injection site reactions or minor colds and two sneezes. They come in worried about serious infections and cancer, and you need to straighten everybody out. And it may not just be the patient, it's their families at home who are, hyping things up in a way that we need to help, re-educate them. And I think that's a huge part of our job, is educating our patients about the different medications.
I also add to the safety conversation that the number one reason I take a patient off these medications, not because of side effects, it's really because it didn't work for them and we had to move on. Yeah. So they're like, oh, not because everyone's getting a cold or getting sick all the time, et cetera. And so they actually understand that, at least that safety part of it, better too.
I think that's right. Uma, you knew this was coming, but there was of course a question here about pregnancy for this class, and maybe just an overall comment for everybody.
So I think we need to take a step back, and that's what I'm going to address in the keynote tomorrow. Take a step back when we think about drugs and pregnancy, and not look at each individual drug, but look at the mechanism. And so if you have a monoclonal antibody that is going to cross the placenta, it's not going to cross significantly in the first trimester. The placenta develops a receptor called the FcRn around week 14, but 80% of that transfer occurs in the third trimester. So in the first trimester, when the bulk of organogenesis is forming, there's no exposure to a monoclonal antibody. So in my practice, when a brand new monoclonal antibody comes to market, I feel very comfortable continuing it in pregnancy. But remember that we worry most about birth defects, and 5% of pregnancies have birth defects, so you have to understand there's a baseline. But there are other things that can go wrong in the pregnancy, so I'm not being glib and saying don't worry about any of it. We need to monitor, we need to track. But in terms of birth defects, continuing a monoclonal antibody is low risk. We actually published our risankizumab placental transfer, and maybe because they have that different FC component, their transfer to the baby was less than in the mother, which is different from ustekinumab. And our data so far in pregnancy is for risankizumab that we don't really see side effects. Small numbers. But I think what you need to go back to is the mechanism. So small molecules will cross the placenta in the first trimester. I have much more concern about their safety in pregnancy. Right.
Breastfeeding with IL-23s?
With any monoclonal antibody, the amount of transfer in breast milk is going to be very minimal. So we are not concerned.
Great. Well, thank you. Great. Let's move on to the next section here, which is really thinking about using these in practice. And then we'll end with two cases to talk with amongst the panel and hear any comments from you as well. So when we think about goals of treatment, you know, we've thought about this in many different ways of the paradigm of IBD treatment, which is, you know, there's this moment of disease onset that often occurs far before we're actually meeting the patients in clinic. Their diagnosis, again, comes at a certain point when you eventually meet a gastroenterologist, but they may have had the disease for a period of time before then. And then we're finally at the point of a decision-making moment where we're thinking about which drug to pick. It's really about risk stratification, having this conversation about safety, and, oh, by the way, is the drug going to be paid for and how quickly can you get it, which unfortunately dominates the sort of end of the discussion over time. But remembering that it's not just about starting the drug, it's about monitoring this patient. And this whole concept of treat to target is not just start drug, hope they heal. It's start drug, really closely monitor your patients. It doesn't mean that you have to check labs every few weeks. It means that somebody needs to check in with the patient. And we all have patients, I'm sure many of you in the audience, I know all of the panel have patients that you tried to do the right thing by starting a drug and bring them back in a few weeks. And guess what? It snowed, there was a cancellation, maybe not for Uma. And it didn't get rescheduled, and then all of a sudden, it's 18 months later, and we never really had a chance to optimize things. So this period between starting the drug and following up with the patient is just critically important. It's not enough to think in your head, we're going to start a good drug and do treat to target. It really is important to find a way to keep track of this over time, and with the goal to not only get them feeling better, heal their bowel, and prevent complications over time. The trouble is, in our field, and these are data just from over the past couple of years that I worked on with another group, was how often are advanced therapies being used within the first 2 years of therapy. And you just heard Vinci and Uma tell you about how these drugs work and the safety. And you heard from Marita about how our patients need these drugs to improve their quality of life. Yet when you look at patients with IBD in the United States, how many of them are getting treated with any advanced therapy? This is any biologic or any small molecule. It's really sad to me that less than 15% of patients with Crohn's disease and less than 6% of patients with UC are seeing these drugs within the first 2 years of their diagnosis. So something is wrong, and we have to help, again, each other and help our field and help our patients understand the importance of early treatment and early assessment of them after treatment starts. You know, we saw back in 2008 the first top-down therapy study that we quote from Gert Dans and Lancet, and we kind of forgot about that somehow for almost 20 years, and there seems to be the sense of surprise that that we repeated the study and looked at early advanced therapy in patients with Crohn's disease, and these dramatic deltas of top-down, meaning starting on early combination therapy with an anti-TNF and a thiopurine, compared to the standard step-up therapy, which you have just seen is what's happening in the United States. We're still predominantly using the step-up strategy, and we really need to make some changes, whether you look at it as clinical response and remission, whether you look at it as endoscopic response, or whether you look at when their flares come, either the first flare or second flare, this top-down group wins all the time. And I don't think there's any question anymore in IBD if it's better to wait for somebody to get sicker and then add therapy versus treating them as early as you can with effective therapies, whether it be a biologic drug, small molecules, some combination of things, really any biologic drug to get started. I think we all win if the default is we're going to start a medication today and then figuring it out versus the default being we're going to wait until you're sick enough to give these medications. And this idea of patients earning or deserving an advanced therapy just has to be a 20-year-old thing and not something now. And going forward, we really need to make this change. And when we think about putting this all together with patients, all the conversations we've been having this evening are about thinking about efficacy and safety as the first things to do. And that's really the science of this. We have the data, we have the knowledge, we now have years of experience with these medications, not just in IBD, but in other disease states like psoriasis as well, that we truly understand the long-term efficacy and safety. But then we get into sort of the art of medicine, is picking which drug for an individual patient. And that's where the conversations, I think, get more interesting, and what make our jobs wonderful is thinking about this idea of personalizing therapy choices. We can never have an algorithm that fits for every single patient that comes in. We think about these factors every single time a patient's coming in, about what type of disease, what type of IBD do they have, not just Crohn's versus UC, but where is the disease? How sick are they? What's the trajectory, or how fast have things been progressing? Those are the things that really help us and make decisions. So we have two cases to present, which are both pretty different, and I'll ask you about treatment, and then I'll ask our panel of what they think. So there are no wrong answers here, of course. They're just different ways to treat patients. Well, I'll argue there's going to be one wrong answer that I'll point out. But this is a 19-year-old college student named Jordan. This is a new diagnosis, comes in with changes in bathroom habits. I'm always proud when a teenage man comes in and actually complains about anything, because they're the ones that I worry about have let things smolder way too long. He's 89 kilos, 191 centimeters, 75 inches. Current symptoms are 3 months of abdominal cramping, 3 to 4 loose stools per day. And here, really, the red flag is the unexplained weight loss. We can certainly come up with reasons why college students may have abdominal cramping and loose stools. But the weight loss is what triggers us here to not say, let's have you come back in 6 months and see how you're doing. You need to get on this right away. So he undergoes a colonoscopy and is diagnosed with moderately active ileal Crohn's disease. What he's been doing so far is using loperamide over the counter, which I think is very common. And while I think we underutilize these medications to treat symptoms, I think sometimes they end up covering up symptoms that we don't end up using the right therapies because our patients are, quote, feeling better, where we know nothing has really changed on the inside. And of course, because this is a new diagnosis, no history of treatment with biologic agents or steroids. So again, he's showing up for the first time here. So I'm going to ask you to respond first. How would you treat this patient? Oh, look at this response. It's been effective tonight. So I talked about there was only one wrong answer. I think there's no role for mesalamine in treatment of Crohn's disease, almost period, right? I mean, maybe the mild Crohn's colitis, we're thinking right about sulfasalazine, and I think that's reasonable. But with ileal disease, the number one answer is do not use mesalamine. We have no data to support it, but I can promise you that it's a delay in therapy and these patients will end up getting sicker before they get better. This is kind of worse than placebo in my mind, Binsey, because we think we're treating something and we're like fooling ourselves. So if there's any message that you've heard 99 times, I'll tell you for the 100th, we're done with mesalamine for Crohn's disease. Just don't use it. Uma, what do you think about the results here?
Well, I think the results are correct and reflect what many people will do in practice. I would say the FDA-approved therapies, you could do budesonide induction, see if he responds, and then move on to therapy. But most of us would move on, start that therapy. Vedolizumab's FDA-approved for Crohn's disease, anti-TNFs, of course, for Crohn's. I think the IL-23 in a 19-year-old man, where you worry about safety, you worry about lymphoma, and it's effective in Crohn's disease, is an excellent choice. I think the only reason I wouldn't use it is if young men tend to be the least compliant with their medication, and if you send him with a sub-Q and you don't follow him, he may not take it, and that would be a reason to go to IV. But otherwise, in terms of safety and efficacy, I think the IL-23 is an excellent choice.
No, I agree with you. Marita, when you're sitting with the patient, this patient, let's say, is University of Chicago and just rolled in as a sophomore, what are the conversations you're having with them about starting a medication, dorm life, disruption to their life, easy ways to treat them?
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest things that I talk about with patients is how are they going to be actionable to be compliant with these medicines. And so talking about certainly about dorm life, you know, we've got shared bathrooms, things like that. So we want treatments that are quickly effective for our patients. So certainly starting with a budesonide taper while bridging them on to an effective maintenance therapy makes sense in my mind. And certainly looking at, you know, what are their prognostic signs, too. I think, you know, I agree with your comment of this is the demographic of patients I worry the most about, and I utilize that Epic reminder feature frequently to make sure that they're able to take their medications because, you know, he's 19, he's in college, so prognostically we know that he's relatively young at his diagnosis. So we want to treat at the appropriate intensity, but also support him to understand the intensity of his disease and the prognostic factors that we're looking to hopefully modify.
Yeah, and Binti, as I sit here looking at the four of us, by the nature of working at academic centers, we're tied to universities that are very close by. So, you know, thinking about the education that goes in, just tell us a little bit about the first visit with, you know, after a diagnosis with a young person, you know, male or female, about, you know, how much they need to know about this.
Yeah, so I first have to explain the disease because they're like, what is this? You're diagnosing me with this chronic disease with no cure, and there's lots of questions. Often we may be able to do a spiel of what this disease is, but sometimes everything goes over their head. Then you have to be very cognizant of how much the patient already knows. If it's someone with family history or let's say a parent comes with them, they may be able to take notes or bring that back home. But if it's a college kid that's coming on their own and finally seeking care, I was like, first kudos to coming in to get care. I do tell them briefly about the disease, but also tell them, look, we can take care of this, get you into remission and lead a normal life. Because they have concerns about how it's going to affect them general day-to-day, how, you know, what are the safety and efficacy of these medications. They're worried about, is it going to interfere with them having a social life in the middle of, you know, class? They need to take time out of college because if their disease was terrible, they may not be able to have so many patients who had to leave a semester or even a year of college because of their severe disease. I think at least telling them just a baseline of, okay, this is the disease, this is what we're going to do about it. We have great treatment options now, and our goal is actually to make sure that we get you into remission, first to make sure they feel better, get them off the loperamide, heal them up, either repeat endoscopy or bowel ultrasound to make sure that areas, that thickening is gone, and to follow them over time, but also educate them on maintaining therapy and adherence being a number one goal, because if they're not taking their medication, and also follow up to make sure they're doing well too. The nice thing with Vedo, anti-TNFs, is that we can check drug levels easily. It's soon with IL-23s, maybe not just to assess for a response, and it's nice to be able to see if they're adherent to therapy too. I do a ton of TDM in my practice, so it's very rare that I see a level of zero in my population because they know, oh, I'm going to see Dr. Abraham, better take my medicine because I know she's going to check my drug level.
It's like, it's like when I floss right before I go to the dentist.
Yes.
They can tell.
Yeah, they can tell.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you do that too? Okay, yeah. It wasn't just me. Okay.
And you can also, yeah, in a 19-year-old, you can also get their mom to help. Because I've found that the moms can be very, very helpful in making sure the kids take their meds.
Uma, if this were a 19-year-old woman, something I do in my practice, and I'm hoping you'll tell me it's okay, is I'll actually start bringing up the safety of these drugs in pregnancy. Yeah. Because I find that I meet women who shook their head yes to taking the drug, and then when I see them a year later, they never started and tell me they were worried that they were never going to be able to have kids. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think that for every woman at childbearing age, one of the first things I say is, you know, this drug is or is not safe in pregnancy, and when you're ready to have that conversation, let's talk first. Another thing I tell them is that women with IBD have reduced ovarian reserve, so don't wait too long if you're really interested in having kids. And that's not something people tell you because you see all these people at 45 having surrogates and other things, but you use your best eggs by 28. After that, it's all downhill. And kids, people need to hear that because they're surprised.
Yeah.
And for IBD, it may be even more because they have lower anti-malarian hormone levels and lower ovarian reserve.
And men, I think, are worried about this too, by the way. I mean, for different reasons, but you're just worried about, oh, my God, if I start one of these meds. There's still, you know, people are still reading about the anti-TNF, you know, 1998 world of once you start a drug, you can never stop it. And I get nervous about men as well being hesitant that, oh, they, you know, they're not thinking about this yet, but they don't want to ruin their chances for having kids in the future, too.
Another thing I really want to point out is this is a young guy who's, let's say he's coming in alone, to let the patients know that they're not alone. Because I think often they feel, oh, gosh, this is a disease. I'm suffering from it. I can't talk to anybody. I can't talk to my roommate or, you know, or dorm mate or friends because talking to going to the bathroom and diarrhea is not a cool thing to talk about in college, you know, a 19-year-old. But tell them, like, we're here at Crohn's and Colitis Congress. Get them linked into the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. Them know that they're not alone. There's other people suffering from the disease. I think we don't always think about it, like, okay, we got to treat the patient, we got to treat their disease, we got to get them on these therapies. But the social aspect is actually huge. So I think telling them, look, you're not alone. Let me, you know, connect you to the Crohn's and Colitis website. There's other people. There's support groups, especially for those within that age range as well. They can be hugely beneficial to make them feel better overall.
Yeah. No, I agree. I always say, and I teach our fellows that. Why this may have been the 18th person you saw that day, it was probably the most important thing that this person did, maybe all year and maybe even in their lifetime, right? Getting a new diagnosis and recognizing the importance of this. Marita, I want to move on. You're really an expert in thinking about treatment goals with patients, and maybe you can just make a comment on, you know, your thinking about aligning treatment goals with patients.
So certainly I think we're all pretty familiar with the STRIDE guidelines and what we're thinking about when we're having our patients have response to medicines. I usually communicate this to my patients as my first goal is always that you feel better, and if at any point in our journey I haven't achieved that, my job is not done. And my second objective relatively quickly is normalizing calprotectin, CRP, perhaps vitamin deficiencies that have been as a result of malabsorption. And then finally, and I always tell my patients it's kind of a fake out that it's a long-term goal because I'm routinely scoping patients or having them come back for ultrasound even sooner at 6 months after starting a therapy. And I think communicating that to our patients as to why are we scoping you and why is it important really improves their ability to adhere to the regimen. Because oftentimes we'll have patients that will come in and they'll say, well, I feel great. There's no reason I should have to go back in and take that day off of work or call my mom to come down to college so I can get a scope completed. But really kind of reinforcing to them that how they feel is really important to us. But then also we have to correlate that to objective markers and we have to benchmark those objective markers. So getting a calprotectin in the beginning is really important, and it also kind of helps our patients see it's a very crude number. It's very easy for them to understand regardless of their educational background of, okay, this is really high, and then this is the goal that we're shooting to. And I think it's quite important also to consider all of our patients individually. Certainly for us, we think of early remission of symptoms, but what does that mean to our patients? You know, as you said, it's asking what have you not done since you've had this diagnosis and what are the things that are important to you? Sometimes it's, you know, young parents that just want to be able to not have those clustered bowel movements in the morning and do preschool drop-off. It's stuff you wouldn't think of necessarily. It's stuff we're not looking at in clinical trials, which is why it's important to personalize our approach. And certainly, our patients can understand that it's important for us to get into a quick remission and that it's important for us to have perseverance of that remission and be able to stay there. And that's, I find, often the easiest alignment of our goals. So certainly, in order to be able to have patients have the ability to adhere, we've got to empower them with education because oftentimes, you know, when they're having a flare or things like that, perhaps they're on vacation, perhaps they're out of town or they're not near our hospital. So we have to be able to educate them so they've got agency to exercise when they're outside of our office. And so really that's reviewing things in an accessible way, at an educationally appropriate way, and in a way that they're able to understand. You know, we've talked about when people come in for their first diagnosis and you can see them just starting to glaze over because they're overwhelmed. And so I think really realizing that and saying, you know what, we're going to do a follow-up video visit in a week or in 2 weeks to make sure that they're really able to keep that information. But also I find following up all of our conversations with a written format of what we've talked about is really helpful too for patients because they have different learning styles as well. And certainly this also helps foster shared decision making. As we've talked about, there's a lot of options, there's a lot of choices for our patients now, and so it's making sure that we're listening to our patients, and we are, I often tell my patients, I'm an advisor, it's my job to give you advice, you are the expert on your body, and it's our job to come to a decision together on what's going to be best for you from a treatment intensity perspective, but then also what you think you can actually execute in the outpatient environment when you leave the office. And certainly, again, as we've talked about, we've got our treat-to-target goals that are important to us, but explaining that to patients in a way that matters to them is important because they may have different targets than we do. We've got our kind of isolated targets here, but their target might be, you know, being able to not have to map out the bathrooms on the way to work, things like that. And certainly talking about, we've mentioned the importance of adherence over time. It's not good enough to feel better and then get off of your medicine, and really thinking about the implications and really explaining to patients the difference between their severity of diagnosis and then their current disease activity, I find is quite helpful in that regard.
Great. Thanks, Marita. That's perfect. We have one more case to really kind of bring this all together. We talked about a new diagnosis of Crohn's disease. Here is Haley, who's a 38-year-old woman with a 2-year history of UC, currently on adalimumab every 2 weeks. Annual review of her treatment plan reveals that there's concern for poor control of inflammation. And in fact, her current symptoms are she's having 5 to 8 stools per day, urgency, as we talked about before, and rectal bleeding. Colonoscopy up to 65 centimeters shows a pretty active disease, Mayo 2 disease. And then labs, you talked about the calprotectin, Marita, of 950, which is pretty high, a CRP of 3.9, which isn't that high but can sometimes be misleading, and then the appropriate infectious workup is negative. So again, a patient who has had 2 years of disease on adalimumab, now pretty symptomatic with fairly active disease. So the question is, what would you do next here? Okay, Uma, again, I'll start with you. So response here, overwhelming for IL-23.
Yeah, so I think, I think you could go from adalimumab to infliximab, capture response. I would not go to vedolizumab because that actually does not work as well when you're bioexposed. You could switch to ustekinumab. You could switch to an IL-23 because those will work in UC even if they've been exposed to adalimumab. So those are all correct. And S1P, again, generally works better when you're not bioexposed, so I would not pick that. And you could go to a JAK because she's been on adalimumab. So I think between a IL-23 and a JAK, depending on her pregnancy goals, depending on her albumin, whether it's greater than 2.5, less than 2.5, those are, and then truly how severe her disease is, the urgency, the bleeding, et cetera. So I think that's where I would go.
Bincy, you talked a little earlier about therapeutic drug monitoring. Tell us about the potential from adalimumab every 2 weeks to weekly, and you know it's not 2010 anymore, right? We have other options.
Well, I would still. My theory is that, or my motto of treatment is that if we can optimize the drug that they're currently on, why not do it before I switch over? So I would definitely even academically get her drug levels to see, is it low, is it high? And if it's low, then I would try to move her to weekly, and maybe that's all, I mean, we don't have to worry too much about changing drug, explain all this stuff, so I would at least get it. If the level is actually good, then I would say, okay, you have good drug level, we need to move on. I would move on to a different mechanism of action.
And do you think that adalimumab is a correct choice in ulcerative colitis? Because we probably shouldn't be using it for UC.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I've had a lot of patients who've done well on adalimumab with UC, and I've had patients who needed to move to weekly dosing, and in fact, a lot of patients who need to move to weekly dosing. Perhaps she's comfortable. So it all comes down to, I think all of these options are great in the specific, you know, areas that you already mentioned, some of those where maybe not do an S1P or JAK inhibitor in this young female if she's considering pregnancy soon. But yeah, I'd say yeah, definitely if the levels are excellent, then I would move on to a different mechanism. Now, we know that from other studies that infliximab still can work with adalimumab failure, either mechanistically, but we don't have a lot of drug level data on that. Was it that we needed more of adalimumab and it would have worked similarly? I don't know. But these are things I would discuss with her. But let's say great alemtuzumab levels, I would consider all the other options for her. I still have seen vedolizumab work well despite especially adalimumab failure, so I wouldn't exclude that necessarily just from my clinical practice experience. So all these are options. If I had the option versus ustekinumab versus IL-23, well, you saw the UC data today, you know, in those comparisons. So, you know, then I would probably consider more the IL-23 versus ustekinumab in this case. But all these others are still an option. In fact, even with the S1P modulator, it's only failed one drug. It still has a good, you know, chance of working. She's moderate, it's Mayo 2 disease, not Mayo 3. So still, if she wants to consider an oral agent, I would still consider those in the armamentarium.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the fact that these are all reasonable. I will say what I'm worried about in these cases is not that she's, you know, that we're not going to start something new. Mm-hmm. That she's been sick for a while. Her colon looks bad. She's having urgency. You know, how much risk do you want to take that this is going to be another 4 to 6 months before you kind of drag this out? And to me, while I think all of these are reasonable approaches, I actually have a pretty low threshold to go to JAK inhibitors these days in somebody who's like sick. You know, if their colon looks like that, I feel like they're a few weeks away from being in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And granted, it's not Mayo 3 yet, and they're not terrible, but I just worry that, you know, dragging this out another few months, because anytime we change one of these drugs, even if you went from every 2 weeks to every 1 week, you want to give them probably a month or two to see if it happens, where, you know, I get nervous about this. And actually, I'd sooner consider infliximab, I think, than I would some of these others, just to think about speed of onset. Uma, you showed at AIBD, you showed a beautiful slide, and you know I loved it because I showed it again, about how to think about extraintestinal manifestations and choosing, and realizing we have 3 minutes and 41 seconds left. Maybe just a very high level, like, how do you think about these drug classes when somebody comes in with extraintestinal manifestations?
So I think, are they bio-naive or bio-exposed? And then I think about the extraintestinal manifestations. So if they have skin, they can get IL-23, they can get anti-TNF. If they have joint issues, they can get anti-TNF or JAK, for example, for ink spot or spondyloarthropathy. If they have atopic dermatitis, it's a JAK. If they have multiple sclerosis, you want to avoid an anti-TNF. So you think about their other diseases, and then you think if they're bio-exposed or bio-naive, and whether it was to a TNF or not a TNF, and then that's how I separate them. Yeah. And fistulas, anti-TNF and JAK.
Yeah. And then, Marita, just maybe the last comment before we wrap things up. You know, this is a 38-year-old woman. We talked about a 19-year-old male. Just think JAK inhibitors and just things that are going through your mind as compared to safety, which we've heard the overwhelming safety with IL-23s tonight.
Yeah, so I certainly always try to beat them to Dr. Google. And we'll often try to, you know, really review the oral surveillance paper and why we have certain guidance and why we have, you know, different orders of treatment in the way that we sequence things. And I think that that's helpful for patients to understand and to realize, you know, why, you know, this medicine might be the correct one for them at this time. To your point, she's been sick for a while, so my bet would be she probably has a low albumin, and perhaps a JAK inhibitor would have a more, you know, rapid uptake in terms of her clinical response.
Yeah, and recognizing that we can say what we want about safety of any of these medications, but when we get that hint that safety is going to be the barrier, again, IL-23s are a great choice to go with for all the reasons that Vinci showed us and we talked about. Well, that's bringing us to the end here, everyone, and we really appreciate you joining us. I think we've gotten through these SMART goals of appreciate the role of IL-23 and the Th17 axis in driving inflammatory pathogenesis, differentiating between IL-23-targeted therapies based on their unique characteristics, and really individualize and optimize patient treatment, like Marita talked to us about. Consider the early use of IL-23 therapies, or really therapy in general, with patients that are coming in. Again, waiting for patients to get sicker is 2 decades ago of how we treat IBD, and we really need to move forward and jump on our patients as quickly as we can with effective therapies. And as I think we all talked about, collaborating with patients to identify the best treatment options to their goals. When patients come into our clinic a question that they all get every time is, what is the most important thing you want to talk about with your provider today? And that really helps us direct that it may not be what we're thinking about, it's about what they're thinking about. And I think as you've all reflected tonight, really understanding what our patients think and what their goals are and what they're worried about is what drives our decision making, probably even more so than the mechanism of the drugs and what we've learned. We want to thank you very, very much for coming tonight and listening to us. Please do visit the Gastroenterology Hub for more resources around inflammatory bowel disease. So with that, I thank our faculty for your great contributions. I thank you for your contributions, and thank you for coming, and have a great rest of your meeting. Have a good night.